Metcast, Thursday, November 20th, 2014. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your Metcast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the Metcast. I know it's been a little while since we last hooked up, got together, and talked about all things Mac, but I think you're going to find it was worth the wait because we have a bunch of great stuff to talk about in this episode. A bunch of things happening on the Apple Mac front, including some updates on what's going on with the iPad Pro. Also, a lot more information coming out about the new A8X chip that is in the new iPad Air 2. Some interesting findings there. Also, we got a couple of software updates in iOS 8.1.1 and 10.10.1 to discuss some bug fixes, and hopefully you're having better experiences now with both of those bits of software. And some updates on the Apple Watch via WatchKit, which came out this past week. So we got all that, plus a bunch of great feedback from you. We're going to talk about continuity and handoff, clearing up some confusion that's going on there. I'm also going to weigh in on AppleCare on iOS devices. Some things happened to me recently that made me rethink my policy on that, and also talk a little bit about SSDs and trim. So we've got that, a bunch of other great tips and hints and things to talk to you about in this episode. But before we get started, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Smile. I want to talk to you today about Text Expander Touch 3, the latest version of Text Expander Touch for your iOS devices. If you're a Text Expander user and don't have Text Expander Touch, now's the time to jump in because this new version brings in custom keyboard support. So that means you can now activate the new Text Expander custom keyboard and get access to all of your snippets for expansion in any app on iOS 8. You can use all of your Text Expander snippets, so your abbreviations will work in Mail and Safari and Messages. All you have to do is flip on the new keyboard, and it works beautifully. Plus, because you have Text Expander Touch, you can sync over all of the snippets. You can also just create snippets on, you know, right inside the app. You can use your snippets inside the app, of course, but the new keyboard makes it really convenient to have that stuff on and available everywhere. And plus, you can do syncing. You can do syncing from your device, or if you're like me and use Dropbox, it has Dropbox support built right in. So I just sync over all my snippets. That way I have what I need on my Mac, on my iOS devices. Completely saves a ton of time on your iPhone and iPad. And, you know, if you're like me and you live in email and you're constantly responding to things, answering a lot of the same questions, setting up snippets is the only way to go. I depend on Text Expander every day. And now the new version also has 14 language keyboards, has additional layouts. So it's really been pumped up and updated. They're constantly adding new features and things like that. So if you haven't checked it out, you should head over to smilesoftware.com. You can get all the details or just search for Text Expander Touch on the iOS store and pick it up today. And a big thank you to Smile for their continued support of the MacCast. Kicking off the news today, that mythical iPad Pro we've been talking about already may be suffering production delays, or I guess they'd be kind of pre-production delays. KGI analyst Ming-Chi Kuo said that Apple's choice of display technology could be causing the release to actually slip into the second quarter. We'd been hearing rumors that Apple might be trying to bring out the larger device, a larger iPad, in the, you know, sometime in the first quarter. I think considering the fact that we've been waiting almost over a year now for this mythical maxi pad, you know, another quarter, does that really mean anything? It hasn't even been officially announced by Apple, of course. This is all rumor and conjecture. But reportedly, Apple's chosen to use an oxide LCD technology. It's supposed to offer higher color saturation, faster response times, which would be great in a display. But as usual, that's being cited as the thing that's causing, you know, production issues, and the quality and the quantity that Apple needs just isn't there yet. So consequently, the analyst thinks that we're not going to see units entering mass production until sometime in the second quarter of 2015. I still have my theory out there that we've talked about, that I think the 12-inch iPad Pro and the Retina 12-inch MacBook Pro might be one in the same kind of device, but I know a lot of people don't share that opinion with me. I think something's going on there. I think Apple's looking at, I hesitate to call it hybrid technology because that has such a bad connotation, but I think they're looking at that final merger of desktop and iOS and playing around with what that might look like and what that device might be. You know, whether it's an iPad with a detachable keyboard or a MacBook Pro with a detachable screen or flip around screen, I have no idea. But I think whatever they release is going to be a very interesting kind of device. But you know, again, not a lot of folks share that opinion with me, but we're just going to have to wait and see. Now, the iPad might have delays, but Apple is on track for production, it seems like, with the Apple Watch. DigiTimes this week claims that suppliers are set to ramp up production of the watch's S1 system on a chip or system in a package chip. That's the processor that's completely sealed. It's got everything in one unit. I think Johnny Ive even mentioned that it's completely encased in resin. So it's all one sealed design, an entire system in one package. And it's looking like that Apple is planning an initial production of 30 million to 40 million units based on what DigiTimes is seeing in the supply chain orders. If so, that is a big number. It seems like Apple would be expecting the Apple Watch to be a massive hit. And I don't know that the smartwatch market has really proven itself as being a big market. Now, Apple is, you know, a lot of people have been waiting on what Apple's going to do. I know I have. I have a Pebble. I've been using it. I like it to some degree, but I just don't know, you know, if this is going to be one of those categories that takes off. But if anybody can make it happen, certainly Apple can, and they definitely have the buzz going with the Apple Watch. Apple Insider points out, though, that the Samsung Galaxy Gear smartwatch only sold 800,000 pieces in its first 2 months. So not even a million units, and Apple's targeting, you know, 30 to 40 times that. I'm a little bit hesitant about that. But Morgan Stanley seems to be on board in agreeing with that Apple number. In an investor note, they said that they predict 10% of iPhone 5 or later owners will buy an Apple Watch in the first year. And that's an interesting figure considering we don't even know when within the year the Apple Watch is going to come out. My prediction is it's going to be sometime later in the second quarter, almost toward the end of the first half. All Apple's really said was that it's going to be out in early 2015. Now, some people have pegged the launch date as early as February 14th. I don't think that's going to be happening. But, you know, if they fall back in that, you know, later half of the year, selling 30 million units in 6 months would be quite a feat. And even at half that, though, you know, even if it was 5% of iPhone 5 owners or later, 15 million units, that would still be, I think, a huge success for Apple. And I think there's no doubt they're going to be hitting those kinds of numbers. But 30 to 40 million units, that's aggressive. But once again, if anybody can pull it off, I think Apple can. Let's talk a little bit about iOS 8 and iOS 8 adoption. It's been, you know, not as quick an adoption rate as prior generations of the operating system. iOS 7 had a huge quick uptake in adoption. iOS 8 has had a little fumbling. Not quite that many people jumped on the bandwagon right away, but recent numbers are showing that things are picking up. These actually come from the App Store, directly from Apple themselves, via the support page for developers. They're claiming that iOS 8 adoption rate is now at 56% of devices running the latest version of the operating system. If so, that means overall iOS adoption is up about 8% over the past month, and that is considerably a quicker uptick than it had been in prior months, about double. And it may be that, you know, people are getting comfortable now that iOS 8.1.1 is out. We're going to be talking about that. Or even 8.1 brought a lot of significant new features, things like Apple Pay, SMS Relay, Instant Hotspot, and also did things like brought back the camera roll that a lot of people were upset about. So between that and iCloud documents being better supported, plus the fact that iOS 8.1 didn't have all the bugs and stigmatism of the 8.0.1 phone killer update, Luckily, I didn't get hit by that one, but I know some of you did. And, you know, you can't push out an iOS update and have it kill people's phone functionality and expect adoption rates to stay good. But it seems like now that that dust has settled, people are starting to feel more comfortable and upgrading. There was also the whole issue of the, some people literally not being able to update because of storage being maxed out on their devices. Because in order to run an over-the-air update, you do need to download the entire installer on a separate portion of your device. That's in case something goes wrong during installation. You can actually, the operating system can roll back itself. And so a lot of people were blocked and just not able to upgrade, not realizing that they could simply dock into iTunes and run the update while, tethered. So that is the alternative if you run into that issue. As far as this latest update, I think it's ranging between a few hundred megabytes to maybe 300 megabytes in terms of download. So check your storage, but you probably should upgrade to the latest version. And we'll be talking about what's specifically in this latest update along with OS X, the latest OS X update, a little bit later in the show. iPhone 6 versus iPhone 6 Plus. The balance of power in terms of sales seems to have shifted a bit, and I don't think this is surprising. Early reports seemed to show that customers were flocking to the larger 6 Plus. On release day, we were hearing that the 6 Plus was going out the door quite a bit faster than the 6, and I really felt that, this was infatuation over the larger screen device. Many of us were waiting and we wanted the thing that was a lot more different. So I think early adopters were going for the 6 Plus, but I fully felt that it was going to kind of balance out at some point and that ultimately the iPhone 6 would be the more popular model. And that seems to be turning out to be true. In a new survey of U.S. customers by Consumer Intelligence Research Partners over the first 30 days, they show that customers are buying the iPhone 6 3-to-1 over the iPhone 6 Plus. Their research showed that over the past month, 91% of customers buying iPhones bought a 6 or a 6 Plus, and that of those, 68% opted for the iPhone 6, while 23-24% went big and got the Plus version. Now, after spending some time with my iPhone 6 Plus, I can tell you that I'm firmly convinced next time I'm probably going to be slimming down when the iPhone 7 hits. I really like the larger screen size. I decided to stick with the 6 Plus, live with my decision, and have it for a year. But I'm already starting to feel that the size is just a bit cumbersome. I think I've mentioned on prior MacCasts that I prefer to keep my iPhone in my front left pocket, and I really noticed the size of the 6 Plus, and that hasn't changed over several, weeks now, months of usage. And I literally have to, when I sit down, take my iPhone out of my pocket, I worry a little bit that I might not notice that I've taken it out. I might leave it somewhere. But then at the same time, I really notice when it's not in my pocket because I don't feel the iPhone 6 Plus bulge. And that's what's really bothering me. As far as the screen size, being able to get work done on it, I absolutely love that aspect of it. And as a matter of fact, I've noticed that I'm tending to flock to my iPad less. And I'm less worried about having my iPad with me all the time because I would take it just in case I had those moments where I wanted to get a little work done, maybe do some notes, some research for the podcast. I prefer doing that on my iPad. Now I can actually do a lot of the same sorts of things on the 6 Plus with the larger screen, and it doesn't feel like a compromise. So I do like that aspect of it, but just the daily convenience of having a device in my pocket, that's not such a great experience. So I think the 4.7-inch display I'm starting to feel is probably going to be the right size for me. But that's also what I'm coming to discover is that this is really a personal choice, and it really depends on your usage, your comfort level, and sort of how you go about your day, which device is going to be right for you. So it's really hard to make a recommendation. A lot of folks want to know, should I get a 6? Should I get a 6 Plus? And you have to kind of analyze exactly how you go through your day. And I hadn't really thought about the concept of just carrying a device with me. How do I do that? What is convenient? What is comfortable? And that's really kind of factored into how I feel about it. So a little update on my opinion on 6 versus 6 Plus. Now let's talk a little bit about that iPad Air, and more specifically that A8 X processor that they threw in there. Now that the device is out in the wild, of course, folks are tearing it down. AnandTech took a deeper look at the latest chip design and found out some really neat things that I think they and a lot of us weren't expecting. Specifically, they looked at the graphics processor in the new chip and found that Apple's using a really unique 8-cluster design that basically lets them cram two Imagination Technologies GX6450 Power VR chips on the same die. So they're all sitting there in the same package. Commercially, I think they only have a 6-core unit. Apple has an 8-core one by, you know, combining those two in the same chip. And basically what the designers have done, according to the report, is taken the PowerVR GPU cores that they licensed and tweaked them into this kind of semi-custom design. And apparently that's something that Apple has within their licensing agreement. It's similar to actually what they do with their ARM-licensed CPUs as well. And on the CPU side, what you've got is a triple-core CPU design, which again is very unique to Apple, along with 2 gigabytes of RAM. And you combine that with what they've done with the GPUs, and basically you've got a processor that is unmatched in the mobile tablet space. And that's really a lot of the technology in engineering that Apple's able to implement that lets them do a lot less with seemingly a lot more in terms of the tech specs. So a lot of people look at the A8 processors and they go, well, they have less RAM, they have less cores. You know, what's going on? Apple's getting extreme performance. And in, you know, real world and benchmarking tests, it shows over and over again that Apple's processors are beating out the competition. And it's this kind of low-level engineering, you know, something that Apple picked up when they started buying up chip design companies. They can take these licensed designs and give them to their engineers and really tweak them and optimize them in the way that they want and hand them off to companies like TSMC and Samsung to actually do the fabrication. And then couple that with the tight integration in the operating system and just do amazing things that are unmatched in the industry. So that is just incredible. And we're seeing and reaping the benefits of that on our side once these products hit the market. So as far as who's going to be continuing to be those partners to produce chips, we heard a little bit about that this week as well. It looks like Apple could be moving back to Samsung as their primary supplier in 2015 and moving even more so to using Samsung in 2016. Now, I will caveat this report with the fact that this is information coming out of the supply chain. So a lot of these sources, you know, can sometimes get stuff wrong. We always take it with a grain of salt. But, you know, to date, Apple had been moving a majority of its manufacturing to TSMC. Samsung is reportedly still supplying about 40% of the chips for the iPhone 6 and 6 Plus. But now, what we're hearing is that they may be shifting back, starting in 2015, moving more majority production to Samsung, and then through 2016, that production level is said to raise up to 80%. So Samsung doing 80% of the production with TSMC picking up the other 20%. And production is supposed to move from a 20-nanometer design all the way down to a 14-nanometer design. So these chips are getting more and more compact, more and more transistors being crammed in there. We've got 3 billion in the latest iPad Air processors, so I would imagine we can expect 4 billion or more as we move forward. Just amazing technology going on. And, I think one of Apple's strengths is the fact that they can have multiple suppliers. They're not locked into one source for these chips. And if they needed more production, I'm sure TSMC would be happy to continue to ramp up on their side as well and take on more capacity. I think we're also hearing that Samsung may build an entire factory just to supply chips for Apple. And this latest rumor, like I said, we're taking it with a grain of salt because it does seem to contradict other reports we had been hearing earlier that TSMC and Apple had been building up a bigger and bigger relationship. I think the other thing that these numbers don't reflect is it's just saying, Samsung is doing this percentage and TSMC is doing that percentage. But overall, both companies are probably ramping up the total number of processors that they're being asked to supply and produce for Apple. So, you know, on both sides, regardless of how much actual capacity or percentage they're of the work that they're doing, they're each going to be taking on more and more orders from Apple. So ultimately, I think it's a good thing for both companies. I'm sure both of them would love to share 50-50 in terms of the split, but you know, Apple is playing the production numbers games. They want to get the best price, they want to get the best capacity, and they have to go with whoever can provide that at the time, even if that means coming back to their favorite frenemy, Samsung. If you're like me, you've probably been tempted by Apple's gorgeous new 27-inch Retina iMac. I'm looking at that thing thinking, you know, I've got some old in the, you know, along in the tooth Macs sitting around the house. I think I have a 2009 iMac that, you know, it'd be nice to update that a little bit. I look at the price tag though, and then I think otherwise. But some interesting stuff happened to me this week where, if by interesting I mean some kind of frustrating, horrible stuff happened to me this week. My 15-inch MacBook Pro 2011 model, which had been, and I think we talked about this, had been exhibiting some of the graphics GPU issues, a little bit of kind of artifacting, tearing stuff going on here and there, and one that I've already had a logic board replaced in once and suspected that it was happening again. Well, it fritzed out. And so I was back in the Apple store talking about getting a replacement. Luckily, they are going to replace it for me, even though I'm not under Apple care. So I lucked out on that one. Remember, we talk about this. It's always good to ask. I figured I'd go in and ask the out-of-warranty service repair. I think the flat rate repair costs about $310 US. They are going to waive that for me, which is very nice of them. Great customer service is always from Apple. But went in and I started thinking, you know, this is going to be the second logic board in here. It's probably going to happen again because this is pretty much a known issue at this point for this model. Very frustrating. I thought, well, maybe it's time to, you know, jump up to that new Retina iMac. Now, I think in store they actually had units available, but this week we're hearing that some users who have ordered Retina iMacs, probably custom build to order stuff, they've been getting emails saying to expect delays. MacNN claimed that in one instance, at least, someone got an email. They had a unit that was set to be delivered between November 14th and 19th. That was pushed back about a week or so, a little over a week, I guess, to the 28th, or being delivered between November 28th and December 2nd. I did a quick check online just to see what was going on. And on the Apple Store online, I'm getting shipping times between 2 to 3 weeks. So that means ships to it between 2 to 3 weeks, and then delivery usually takes a week or 10 days or something like that, a little bit longer. Online, though, if I want to do pickup, my five local Apple stores are all showing availability for immediate pickup. So not sure. It seems like in channel, maybe there's some iMacs out there, but maybe in production, they're starting to experience some delays. I'd be curious if you've ordered a Retina MacBook Pro, did you get one of these emails? Are you going to be able to get it when you want to get it, or are you experiencing delays in your shipment as well? Shoot us an email, maccast@gmail.com, and let us know. As noted a little bit earlier, there are a couple of OS updates out, both for iOS and Mac. First, iOS 8.1.1 was released, and as usual, it had its very limited release notes. Apple simply noted that it contained bug fixes and stability and performance improvements for the iPad 2 and the iPhone 4S. That second part, a lot of folks are excited about, especially if you have older devices, because performance wasn't all that great with iOS 8. It seems to be a little bit better. Some of the early reports are noting that it's still not great, but hey, things are improving. There were also some minor tweaks to the health app, and one fix that I'm particularly excited about, the order of action and share extensions in the system share sheets now actually do stick. So you had been able to move those around, and specifically, I like to put 1Password, you know, further up in the list so that I get quick access to it. Well, you'd go back to use the share sheet and it'd drop right back to where it was before. That is now fixed. It will stick and stay in place. They also addressed an iCloud hanging crashing bug that seemed to be affecting some folks. So when you opened up an app that worked with iCloud, it would just instantly crash when you tried to do anything like open a document, something like that. And also there's a slew, and I think that's the technical term, a slew of security updates. So this is definitely one you're going to want to grab. As I said earlier, the update is reported to be anywhere between 64 megabytes to up to 364 megabytes, depending on your version of iOS. But you can get it through software update on your iOS device or through software update when connected into iTunes on the Mac. Mac OS 10.10.1, and I think it's just OS 10.10.1, right? I'm never going to give up the Mac part. But basically, the latest update for Yosemite is out. It reportedly improves the Wi-Fi reliability. That was a common issue a number of folks were having. I think we talked about that on a prior episode of the MacCast, where one of you was actually having your Wi-Fi go down after about 10 to 30 seconds of booting up your Mac, something that is not good. That is supposedly fixed, but not for everybody, apparently. There's still widespread reports of people continuing to have issues, not only with Wi-Fi, but also Bluetooth. There is a list of possible fixes from the folks over at OS X Daily. I will have a link to that in the show notes at maccast.com. So if you're still plagued, even after the 10.10.1 update, by Wi-Fi, Bluetooth connectivity issues, you might want to check out that list, see if any of those things improve your ability to connect. Starts with simple things like just resetting network preferences and goes all the way down to, you know, of course, the dreaded full reinstall of the operating system. But go down the list and see if one of those might address that issue. There is a whole list of other fixes. I have the full list in the show notes at maccast.com, but some of the highlights are improves reliability when connecting to Microsoft Exchange server, resolves an issue that could have prevented mail.app from sending messages through certain email service providers. So if you've been having trouble sending mail, you might want to make sure you grab this update. Also addressed an issue that could cause notification center settings to be lost after restarting. That would be particularly annoying, and resolves an issue that may prevent Time Machine from displaying older backups. So if you've been activating Time Machine in Yosemite and not finding some of your older backups, this fix will address that. Like I said, there's a bunch of other stuff in there. One of the other highlights is something that I found out about through a notification, an email notification from Dropbox. Apparently, there was a bug that would occasionally cause third-party apps to crash when trying to use Open Save As or trying to save a file using the Finder integration for the cloud services. So that reportedly has been fixed in 10.1.1 as well. There's also some additional security and privacy updates. So definitely an update you're going to want to grab. Just run software update through the Mac App Store and it should pop up for you. But like I said, there's still some lingering bugs. Mac Rumors had a list. In addition to some people still having the Wi-Fi issues, they noted that OS X Yosemite's dark mode on non-Retina displays is still giving some people trouble, and that some people are seeing high CPU utilization after running the update. I'm not running OS X Yosemite on my main system yet, so I haven't had a chance to check out the update, but I'd be curious to know how your experience has been. If you've been having issues, are they resolved, or do you have any new issues? Shoot us an email, maccast@gmail.com. And then the last software update or OS update to let you know about is there is an update out for the Apple TV. If you have a third generation, software update 7.0.2 was also released. It's supposed to contain general performance and stability improvements, along with some additional security fixes for the Apple TV. And of course, you can grab that by going into the settings area of your Apple TV and running software update if it hasn't already been installed. One of the new technologies that's in iOS 8 that I am most excited about, but we haven't heard a lot about, is HomeKit. And that's mainly because there aren't any HomeKit devices out on the market yet, but that's looking to change very soon. Last week at their Made for I Summit, the MFI Summit in China, Apple supposedly asked device manufacturers to start submitting their home automation products for approval under the program. Another thing that we had heard was that Apple recently set some requirements for HomeKit devices that they need to ship with a Bluetooth and or with Bluetooth and Wi-Fi chips, rather, that are from approved Apple vendors. I would imagine that's in an effort to make sure that there's seamless compatibility with the HomeKit technology and operating system. The certification process is typically one of those last steps that's going to happen before products start actually shipping and making their way into the marketplace. So hopefully that means we'll see some HomeKit compatible products hitting the store shelves really soon. I'd love to see some of them start to hit before the holidays. If you're thinking about a present for me, anything that's HomeKit enabled, specifically maybe some lighting, thinking Hue bulbs, things like that, I would love to see that sort of stuff. So hopefully that'll be coming out and start integrating with our apps on our iOS devices very, very soon. We still don't have a lot of details on specifically how HomeKit will work and what it's going to look like to consumers. I imagine a lot of the stuff is going to be behind the scenes, because really what it is it's an app kit that allows developers to offer tighter integration with not only our iOS devices, but other HomeKit-enabled smart devices that we might have on our home networks. Basically, what this is going to do is it's going to open up devices to be able to work together in a much more robust and integrated way so that we can do actual home automation and control. As it stands now, we have these smart connected devices, things like a Nest thermostat, or maybe you have a sprinkler controller or a lighting controller, but they're really tied into the vendor's app, and one app really can't talk to another. So you can't set up scripts, or what specifically Apple is going to call scenes, that would allow you to kind of trigger multiple devices and actions to kind of happen all at once with a single command. So really the promise of HomeKit is that it's going to enable us to do that sort of thing. And one of the really exciting parts to me too is that HomeKit offers up Siri integration. So not only will you be able to kind of set up these scenes, but you'll be able to actually trigger them with voice commands using Siri, which is going to be an amazing thing to see. But of course, we have to have the connected devices and the products out in the marketplace to make it all happen. And with the news this week, it looks like we're getting one step closer to that actually happening. And once we have the products and the HomeKit integration, I'm going to be curious to kind of talk about what we all are doing with the technology, because I think that's where the real power lies, right? Having the ability to do these things is one thing, but people actually sitting down with the technology, figuring out how to create scenes and connect different things together, I think there's going to be a lot of creativity we're going to be able to impart on the technology. And that's where the real power is going to come into play. So hopefully on future episodes of the MacCast, I'll be sharing with you some of the things that I'm doing. And I'd love to hear some feedback and hear the kinds of things that you're doing. I know people are already doing really creative stuff with If This Then That and a lot of the devices that they're using now. I just found out about some new cool things people are doing with Launch Center Pro, which is a bit of iOS technology and iOS app that I haven't really checked out. It lets you script all kinds of things on iOS, and I hadn't realized that you could integrate it with If This Then That and sort of these web calls to do all kinds of cool automated stuff with, the devices and technology you have now. So I'm going to be digging into that a little bit as well, and hopefully I'll be covering that on a future episode of the MacCast. So I did want to mention, if you have been playing around with Launch Center Pro, I know it's something that Federico Vici over at Mac Stories has written up some great articles on. I'm going to be digging into those, but I'd love to know what you're doing with that kind of technology and anything home automation, scripting, that sort of stuff. I think we'll cover on some future episodes of the MacCast, so stay tuned for that. Another thing I'm very excited about, of course, is the Apple Watch coming out. We talked a little bit earlier, but now we have some more specific details, because Apple released the Watch Kit to developers. This is the piece of OS X and Xcode that's going to allow them to integrate with iOS. Specifically, they also released iOS 8.2 beta to developers, and the SDK is now there. Devs can start playing with app development, setting up glances and actionable notifications with their apps to integrate with the Apple Watch. But the one thing that was discovered is that this first release is somewhat limited. Developers are not going to be able to create fully native apps, at least not until next year. So what the kinds of Apple quote-unquote apps that they will be able to create now are basically going to be extensions, and it's going to be an extension that is in iOS 8.2, and then it will be pushed from the iPhone app to the Apple Watch. So in essence, the app that's on the watch is more or less a user interface, and all of the data and information is going to be kind of triggered and sent from the iOS device, at least initially. So you launch the app, it's going to trigger the iPhone WatchKit extension on iOS on your phone, running in the background, and then it will wirelessly transmit data to the Apple Watch for display and feedback and things like that. So to me, this is feeling like it's going to feel a little bit like the early days of iOS app development. Remember, we couldn't do a whole lot with our apps, but slowly over time, Apple opened things up and it got better and better. And when we finally get full native apps being able to run on the watch, some really interesting things are going to happen. I think still some really interesting things are going to happen right out of the gate. Developers are going to be very creative about how they use this technology, how they set up glances and actionable items and widgets and things like that. So I don't think it's going to detract from the launch of the watch, but it is not going to be, you know, everything all at once right up front is what it's sounding like. But because we have the watch kit information out and available now, there's some other things we're starting to learn. One interesting thing is that when you install an iOS app that has watch support, it will actually prompt you to install the watch app if you have a paired Apple Watch present. So it's going to automatically recognize, hey, you've got an Apple Watch, this app supports that. You want to install this application on your watch. So a little bit more about how the application install experience is going to go. We also got to learn about the resolutions for the two versions of the Apple Watch. The 38 millimeter version is going to have a 727 by 340 display, the 42 millimeter, a 312 by 390 display. And you know, I think for app developers on the UI side, obviously dynamic layouts are going to be a big thing. You're going to have to go with that because you've got two different resolutions, and I would imagine in the future Apple's going to be playing around with those resolutions. So actually trying to do pixel-perfect layouts is something you're likely going to want to avoid. And it's not going to be too hard to avoid, at least at first, too, because we're learning there's just really two types of layouts. One they're calling hierarchical, which is one screen per, you know, one choice per screen. You basically drill down to the destination you want to get to. You can think of this kind of like how mail.app works. And then the other type of layout is what's called page-based. This is where you navigate between pages by swiping horizontally on the interface. And that's more like how you would interact with the weather app. We also got the official name for the font that's going to be used on the Apple Watch. Apple's calling it San Francisco. And you may remember, if you're an old school Mac guy like me, we had a San Francisco font back in the day. It's not the same one. San Francisco font kind of looked like almost like a ransom note. It was all these different styled kind of characters mushed together. San Francisco on the Apple Watch is much cleaner. And not surprisingly, it also supports iOS dynamic type. Dynamic type is the kind of type that adjusts its letter spacing and line height dynamically depending upon the font size that's being used. So as the UI changes and goes up and down, the type's going to look great across the board. And again, that's another thing the developers are probably going to want to tap into. It turns out they can load in their own fonts, but they're not going to get that dynamic type functionality just built in for free. So my guess is that most developers most of the time are going to be sticking with the system level font, at least on the watch UI. And interestingly, too, developers need to submit a square version of their application icon. That's despite the fact that on the watch interface, on the home screen, all of the icons actually appear in circles in those little, what Apple is calling neighborhoods. So developers have to submit a square version of the logo or icon, and then they're actually going to mask it into the round shape in software. So that's kind of a serious safe area. I think Apple has a spec for that too in their UI guide, but developers are still having to do square icons versus round ones. And Apple did set up a website for developers, a WatchKit website. I'll have a link to that in the show notes in at maccast.com if you want to check it out. They actually have a really nice video that kind of gives an overview of WatchKit and the kinds of things that developers will be able to do with it. And along with that, they, of course, have documentation like a programming guide and some user interface guidelines that developers can follow. I've kind of bookmarked those for myself. I'm going to be reading up into them a little bit more, and hopefully we'll have more information and details about Apple Watch on future episodes of the show. But then the last thing I have for you in the news for this week are just what I'm calling some odds and ends. And actually, I might turn this into more of a regular feature toward the end of the news segment of the MacCast. That's because I often have these little stories that pop up in my feed that they likely don't have enough detail to warrant their an entire segment of their own. But there's still things that we should probably address and talk about. And so two of those for you this week. The first one is the Financial Times is reporting that Apple has plans to bundle the Beats application as one of the kind of default built-in apps in future versions of iOS. So this would fall into that whole I can't remove this from my device category. I'm not sure how I feel about this one, because Beats would still require a subscription to be to actually be able to use the software. So they're kind of, you know, giving you an app that a lot of us, if we don't have a Beats subscription, we're not going to be able to use. Now, Apple is reportedly trying to get the price of a monthly Beats subscription down to $5 a month, which I think would help. I always kind of had the hope that Beats might be rolled into the iTunes Match, iTunes Radio service, and you'd kind of get everything for that one set yearly price. We're not hearing that now. It seems like Beats going to stay a separate thing and still be subscription. But $5 a month might help make the fact that you can't remove the app from your device a little less stingy. Is that the way to say that? But, you know, in my opinion, it's just going to be one of those apps that then can join Stocks and Tips and Find My Friends in iOS Siberia, you know, that last screen where you kind of shove all the Apple apps that you can't remove but you really don't use. Yeah, I think it's going to be another one of those. But I think Apple's hoping that they'll sell maybe some more Beats subscriptions if it's just built in, and that may very well be the case. And then finally, next time you open up the App Store, you might notice a small but significant change specifically to free applications. They are no longer being labeled as free. Apple has made the choice to change the free button to simply say get. This is reportedly in response to some pressure from the EU over in-app purchases. So the fact that, you know, the free label for an app that requires in-app purchase or has in-app purchase really isn't technically free, and some consumers may be confused over that and not really understand that. I think consumers are a little bit smarter, but you know, maybe this will make it clear. The word get is an interesting choice, I think, that Apple made. It makes the button a lot smaller, which may help on maybe some of the smaller screens, but it just looks a little odd the first time you go in there and take a look at it. But Apple did make that change, and you will probably see it next time you go to download one of your favorite, can we call them free apps still? Are we allowed to use that term? I don't really know. When you go to download an app and it doesn't have an upfront price, it will now simply say get. Maybe that's the best way to say that. I have no idea. But that's going to do it for the news for this week. Now I want to follow up on something we talked about on a prior episode of the MacCast. I had mentioned a software update for the Apple TV. When Apple released version 7, it was made available for the third-gen Apple TVs only. And I said that along with that software update, Apple TVs got peer-to-peer AirPlay support. This is the technology that would allow guests coming into your house to actually be able to play AirPlay content on your Apple TV without actually having to connect to your wireless network. So they could stream AirPlay directly from their Mac or iOS device right onto your Apple TV. Very cool feature, something I was very excited about to get on my Apple TV. But what I didn't know, and listener Mike emailed me about, is that there are actually two generations of the third generation Apple TV, I guess kind of two versions. There's A1427, which was the original third generation Apple TV. And then there's the later A1469 Apple TV. That's revision A. And the model numbers, Apple TV 3.1 is the A1427 version, and Apple TV 3.2 is the A1469 version. And I only bring this up because it turns out that the peer-to-peer AirPlay is only supported on the 1469 Revision A model. So hopefully I didn't cause any trouble or confusion for you when I read off that report. If you want to know which version of the third generation Apple TV you have, you can simply look on the bottom, although to me it's a little hard to see because it's that whole glossy black on flat black kind of look. My old eyes had a hard time seeing it, so I think the easier way to check is simply go into settings on your Apple TV, into the About screen, and just check the model number there. And if you have the A1469 model, then you're good to go with the peer-to-peer AirPlay with the latest software update. And remember, we're now at 7.0.2 on the third generation Apple TV model, so if you don't have that listed when you're checking the About for the model number, you probably want to run your software update. One of the big new features in OS X Yosemite that we talked about on the last episode was handoff. And I think we were specifically talking about the fact that handoff has some very specific requirements in terms of your Mac and your iOS devices and what is supported. And I had mentioned that only newer model Macs are actually supporting the handoff feature, and that led to some great feedback and some great comments, including some comments like this one from Benjamin.
Hi, Adam. It's Ben Brune-Cox from the UK here. I thought I would just send you a little note in because based on a couple of weeks ago, we were talking about handoff and how that's working with certain types of machines, and obviously older ones are not working. I'm pretty certain you said 2011 was the cutoff point. I know it's different down to different hardwares with the handoff stuff and Bluetooth and stuff. But I've got an iMac which is a 24-inch mid 2007 model, running Yosemite, obviously 2.4 Intel Core 2 Duo, 4 gigs of RAM, not a high spec machine at all, and handoff is working absolutely perfectly. With telephone and voicemail, with telephone and messages and everything really, so that's running fine. So as I said, it's a mid 2007 24-inch iMac. Anyway, I just thought I'd better let you know. Keep up the great work, and I'll be listening every week. Cheers.
Hey Ben, thanks. I appreciate the feedback, and actually, that feature is working perfectly also on my early 2011 MacBook Pro, which does not support handoff, according to Apple. And I wanted to play your voicemail because I think there is, or I know there's actually some confusion. And this isn't just you. I'm not singling you out, and hopefully this doesn't make you feel bad, because it shouldn't. A lot of people, I think, are very confused about Apple's marketing terms with respect to handoff, because handoff is a part of OS X Yosemite. It's one of those marketing buzzwords, and it is just one part of what Apple calls continuity. So the feature that you're talking about is actually part of continuity, Apple's umbrella term for this set of features in OS X Yosemite that are aimed at more seamless integration of our Macs and our iOS devices. And so within continuity, there are three really main features. One of them is handoff that we were talking about on the last episode. The other one is instant hotspot. And then there is also, in sort of the last category, SMS relay. And what you're talking about, the feature you're talking about, phone relay. And so I thought this is a good opportunity to kind of go into these three different categories and kind of explain things and explain how they work. But just overall, what you need to know is that we have continuity, which has these three features, and handoff is a specific part of that. So with SMS relay and phone relay, the requirements are that you have an iPhone running iOS 8, and because it uses Wi-Fi, it is supported on a broader range of devices. So what you have to make it work, basically, is you need to make sure that you're logged in and using the same iCloud and logged into and using the same FaceTime account on both your Macs and your iOS devices. And when I say the same account, this is really specific. Another listener emailed in to let me know that you really, if you're using an iCloud email login, you need to make sure that you're using the same exact extension as well across the board to get this to work reliably. I haven't confirmed this, but it kind of makes sense with how Apple seems to implement things. So if you choose to log into iCloud with @iCloud.com, you're going to want to make sure that you use @iCloud.com on all of your devices and Macs. Same thing with your FaceTime account. And that'll just make this process, I think, work a little more seamlessly. Even if it isn't necessarily required, it's probably a good thing just for consistency. It makes it easier to kind of do. But then once you've made sure that you're logged in on all those devices, then you also need to do a couple of additional things. On your iPhone, you need to go into settings, into FaceTime, and make sure that you've checked on and enabled the iPhone cellular calls option. And then on your iPhone, you also need to go into settings under messages, under text message forwarding, and make sure that SMS forwarding is turned on for each device that you want to be able to receive SMS messages on. So between all of that, you should be able to get SMS relay and phone relay working across your Macs and devices. And again, because it uses Wi-Fi, the fact that all your devices are on the same Wi-Fi network for the connectivity, it is supported on a broader range of devices. Now, the next two features, Instant Hotspot and Handoff, have more strict requirements because they're reliant on that low-energy Bluetooth technology, and that's only available in newer model Macs, the specific kind of low-energy Bluetooth that you need. So for Instant Hotspot, basically what this allows you to do is if you have personal hotspot enabled on your device and you have the cellular plan that actually supports personal hotspot, and you're logged into, again, the same iCloud account on all your devices, your Mac and your iPhone, then what can happen is your iPhone will simply appear in the Wi-Fi list, and when you select it to use the Instant Hotspot, you don't have any additional authentication. So you don't have to, it'll use your iCloud account to do the authentication. You don't have to put in a password or anything like that. So you can get on your personal hotspot connection a lot quicker. And then the last bit is of continuity is Handoff. And Handoff, this is specifically the technology that lets you move from an app on one device, say your iPhone, to the same app on another device like your Mac seamlessly. So you can do things like start an email on your iPhone and then move into mail.app on your Mac, pick up right where you were at without having to do anything. It's just this seamless transition. Similarly, you could start a Keynote project on your iPad and then move over and finish it up on your iPhone. And Handoff is built into all of Apple's apps, Mail, Safari, Pages, Numbers, Keynote, Maps, Messages, Reminders, Calendar, and Contacts, but it's also being enabled and supported because there's an API available to developers on some third-party apps. So more and more third-party apps are getting the Handoff functionality built in. So you can start, say, a Byword document on your iPhone and then pick that back up on your Mac. And even more interestingly, something I didn't know is that the Handoff API even can work between a native app on one platform and a web app. So you can do Handoff there. I haven't heard of any specific use cases for that or apps that are actually doing that. If you happen to know one, let me know because I'd like to check that out. But it can even work, you know, seamlessly across, I guess, iOS device to web browser or web app. And what happens if you have Handoff support working and set up on your Mac is you'll see a little dock extension kind of to your dock icon in OS X Yosemite off to the left-hand side, and clicking that application icon will then open up that app and let you pick up where you left off. On your iOS devices, it's somewhat similar. What you'll see is a little icon on the lower left-hand corner of your lock screen. And another point of confusion, because even if you have a, you don't necessarily support the Handoff from OS X Yosemite to your iOS devices, some people will notice that they get a little app icon when you're out and about to launch a specific app. So say you have the Starbucks app installed and you're near a Starbucks, you'll see that little, what looks like a Handoff icon on your lock screen for the Starbucks app. That's actually not technically part of Handoff. What that is that's another feature in iOS 8 that Apple calls location-aware apps. So it can use the GPS and the location data to know that you're near a store or a location that can benefit from an app you have installed on your phone, and offers a quick way to launch that from the launch screen. But I think technically that's not part of Handoff or continuity. I could be wrong on that, but I'm pretty sure that's the case. So for Handoff and Instant Hotspot, like we were talking about on the last episode, it does require specific Mac models and that you be running OS X Yosemite. So specifically, you need a MacBook Air mid-2012 or later, a MacBook Pro mid-2012 or later, an iMac late-2012 or later, a Mac Mini late-2012 and later, or a Mac Pro 2013 edition. So those are the models that are going to have the supported Bluetooth for the Instant Hotspot and the Handoff portions of continuity. Everybody else, because, again, it's Wi-Fi, we get continuity support for SMS relay and phone relay if we want to take advantage of that. So it's really cool that we do get some stuff. I wish there was broader support for things like Handoff and Instant Hotspot. And, Ben, I hope this kind of clears up, not just for you, but for a lot of folks, kind of the confusion over, you know, continuity versus Handoff. It's been a while since I think we talked about AppleCare and sort of my philosophies and thoughts on AppleCare. It may have been years. I might not have addressed this with you for years now. But the gist of my philosophy on AppleCare is I've always purchased AppleCare with my Macs, specifically any Mac that has an LCD screen attached to it. So that would be MacBook Airs, MacBook Pros, iMacs, those sorts of things. Mainly because I think adding the 2 years of extra coverage on something that has a display that may go bad, it ultimately makes it worth it. Because if you have an issue go wrong, and specifically if it's the display or the logic board, those are particularly costly repairs. And so up front, you pay a couple $100, but to have that peace of mind, I actually really like. Now, with iOS devices, I've always had a separate philosophy. I never felt, specifically before Apple released AppleCare Plus, that it was really necessary, especially for folks like myself who often are replacing their devices every few years. So with AppleCare on iOS devices, you get an additional year of coverage on top of the default year of coverage. And until recently, it really didn't cover accidental damage. Well, now with AppleCare Plus, we do have the two incidents of accidental damage with, you know, a deductible. And I started to rethink my sort of philosophy on AppleCare. And what really happened was I had a couple of mishaps with my devices, and you heard about both of them if you've been a listener for a while on this episode. But just to recap, I had one incident where I left my iPad and my iPhone on top of my car and drove away. Both were damaged. Luckily, the iPhone, it was just a back glass replacement, but the iPad itself had to be replaced under the out-of-service warranty. So I had to completely replace the iPad. Luckily, it wasn't a full cost because I believe it was a 64 gigabyte model. It would have cost about $800 to replace. I ended up being out of pocket around $300 or so at the time. And I've always been, you know, generally pretty careful. And like I said, I replace my devices frequently. So I never thought AppleCare Plus was something I needed. The second incident that I had was I went swimming with my iPhone 5S. And luckily for that one, I had purchased the AppleCare Plus because of the iPad incident. So after the iPad incident, I decided, you know, maybe it's good for me to have that accidental damage for those few times. And when I purchased that, I believe the way it was set up is in the price for AppleCare still is $99 to add that to any iOS device, be that an iPad, any model iPad, or any iPhone. But also the accidental damage cost was a $49 per incident. And I think it's still that price on the iPads, but more recently Apple upped that price to $79 for iPhones. And so what's happened now is it's gotten me rethinking whether or not AppleCare Plus on an iOS device is a good deal. So I had flopped. I had started saying, no, I generally don't recommend AppleCare for iOS devices, to, hey, if you're not going to be replacing them frequently and if you're the type of person who's prone to accidental damage, it may be worth it to spend the $100 up front to kind of have that peace of mind. And what's changed recently is I've been talking to a couple folks who have had some accidental damage and not had AppleCare Plus, and I started to find out about some of the replacement costs. So I think for a lot of us, the accidental repair damage that we're going to need with our specifically iPhones is going to tend to be glass breakage, right? You're carrying it, you're walking along, something slips, it falls on the ground, the glass breaks. So you're going to go in if you have the AppleCare Plus, and you're going to pay your $79 and you're going to get a new screen. But what happens if you don't have AppleCare Plus? Well, it turns out for an iPhone, if you don't have AppleCare Plus, the screen replacement cost on an iPhone 6 is $109. $109. For an iPhone 6 Plus, a 5S, a 5C, or a 5, the cost is $129. So that got me thinking, if you add the $99 upfront cost for AppleCare and then you add on the $79 per incident cost for your first accident, then it's going to cost you, with AppleCare Plus, essentially $178 for that first replacement screen. If you just paid out of pocket, your maximum cost is going to be $129. So at least if you only have one incident during the life of your AppleCare Plus, you would save $49 by not having the AppleCare Plus. And I'll have a link to this pricing. The information is on Apple's website. I'll have a link to that in the show notes at maccast.com if you want to check this out for yourself. Now, if you have a second incident, it sort of flips around, right? You're better off if you damage your phone twice while having AppleCare Plus. Then you're going to have the $99 plus two $79 incidents. So what, that's basically $180 versus maybe paying $230 to get two screen replacements without the AppleCare Plus. So you're in essence saving $80. But, you know, it all starts to become this little bit of a gamble. Like, how many times am I going to accidentally damage my iPhone to kind of justify the cost for AppleCare? Now, of course, accidental damage coverage is not the only reason you get AppleCare. But I think for a lot of people with their iOS devices, it is why they're buying it. They're buying it because of the screen damage protection. And if that's your only reason, then you may want to look into these numbers a little bit more closely and kind of think about, you know, what is going to be the ultimate best benefit for you. And also remember that I'm talking about Apple's costs for screen replacement. There are third-party companies that can do screen replacements even cheaper than what Apple would charge. So that changes the numbers even a little bit more. The only thing that I'll warn you about with sort of third-party screen replacements is you may or may not get OEM, original equipment manufacturer parts. You may or may not get a part that is actually the same part that Apple uses. And that can affect the quality of your display and the responsiveness of the touchscreen and stuff like that. So you kind of have to shop around and make sure that you're getting, you know, the right part replacement, not just getting the cheapest thing that you can slap on the front of your iPhone if that sort of thing concerns you. And again, it's important to remember that I'm only looking at screen damage. If you have other kinds of accidental damage, like water damage, you know, that changes the numbers around completely as well, because you're going to have to pay a lot more. You're going to have to pay basically for a phone replacement or an out-of-warranty replacement, and those costs are much higher. For example, an iPhone 6 Plus out-of-warranty replacement is going to cost you $329 without AppleCare Plus. Obviously, if you have AppleCare Plus and you had something like water damage, then you're just going to be paying the $79. So that benefit becomes a little bit better. And at the same time, interestingly, iPads are a much different story. I think AppleCare Plus still makes sense on iPads because your out-of-pocket cost without AppleCare Plus is much higher. It seems like the only thing they offer is out-of-warranty replacements when looking at the page on Apple's website. And I guess, you know, maybe what Apple is thinking is that iPads are less prone to accidental damage because they're not carried around everywhere. So they have a lower per incident fee with AppleCare Plus. It's still only $49 versus the $79. So you factor those two things in, the fact that you can't just get a screen replacement on an iPad. You've actually got to pay for a replacement of the entire device. And AppleCare Plus for accidental damage coverage looks a lot better on the iPad. For example, an iPad Air 2 without AppleCare Plus would cost you $379 to replace versus the $49 with the AppleCare Plus. And I know that, you know, we're talking about here just AppleCare protection. There are a lot of other ways to get coverages for your devices that you might want to factor into your decision. Things like some credit cards carry damage coverage for devices. You know, look into and check with your credit card company to see if that's something. And be sure you look into the details. Things like, do I have a deductible? What's it actually going to cost me? Is it zero out of pocket, or do I have some out-of-pocket costs? There's also third-party accidental damage insurance that you can buy from various companies. And you can also get, you know, insurance from your carrier, AT&T. Now, I still specifically think those are a bad deal because typically it's like a $10 a month cost. So for, you know, the life of your two-year contract, you're going to be paying like $240 versus maybe just $99 with the AppleCare Plus. So you got to kind of make your decision there. But just looking at AppleCare, I think I've started to come to the decision that for me, I'm getting it mainly on my iPhone for the accidental damage coverage and mainly for the screen coverage. So I may in the future opt not to get the AppleCare Plus and just go with the, you know, per incident glass replacement cost, which ultimately, if I only break the screen once, ends up being lower. If I do it twice or more, then, you know, all bets are off. But hopefully I am not that much of a butterfingers with my phone. And to date, you know, I've only had the two times where I've actually had accidental damage coverage. So I think in the long run, I'd make out ahead. But your mileage may vary. You may be the type of person that drops their phone more frequently or has more incidents of damage, and maybe AppleCare Plus pays off for you. I don't really know, but it's certainly something to think about and something that kind of came up this week, so I wanted to bring it up on the show. Another question I get asked about a lot is specifically pertaining to SSD and flash storage and something called trim. We're going to talk about what trim means or is here in a second, but basically the reason this is coming up is because more and more of us are either buying Macs with flash storage or upgrading our existing Macs to SSDs. And what's awesome about SSD and flash storage is that unlike traditional spindle hard drives, data access, data read times, and write times are much faster. It's solid state. Well, they're much faster when the drive is brand new. But there's a little unknown thing about these drives that people don't talk about too much, is that over time, performance can actually degrade and slow down unless you have a technology running like trim. And I kind of wanted to get into what the problem is and talk about why we're discussing it before I get into sort of some of the solutions and what trim is. So bear with me here for a second. But in essence, you know, on hard drives and SSDs, so when I say hard drives, I'm going to be talking about, you know, your traditional spindle hard drive with the arm that goes back and forth to read the data off the drive. With both of these things, you have to understand how data is stored, right? Data is stored in something called data blocks. And you don't need to understand anything more than, you know, it's storing information on these little segments or portions of the drive called blocks. And each block can have data from more than one file on it. So each block stores a certain amount of information. You can have partial information, bits from different files stored on a block and a hard drive. And so that can be split. And when a file is deleted in the file system, it actually doesn't do anything to the block. It just sort of marks that block, tells the operating system, says, okay, I can write to that portion of the drive, but it actually doesn't erase it. What happens is the next time you need to write to that area, if it's been marked as deleted, it can go ahead, erase it, and then write to that block. And on a hard drive, it does exactly that. It quickly deletes it and then writes the new data information. On SSDs, the problem is SSD can't delete just a portion of the block. So if you have, you know, a bit of a file on a block and a bit of another file on the same block, the SSD has to delete the entire block before it can actually reuse it. So in order to facilitate that, because it has to write the entire block, so imagine you've got this block, it's got a little bit of two files on it. One of those files has been deleted and it wants to use that space. Well, what it has to do to clear the block is basically put a copy, so read that block that it needs to replace, put a copy of that into cache, make its changes, so merge the extra file data onto it, delete that original block, and then write the changed block it has from cache back into it. As opposed to on a traditional hard drive where it just wipes out the, you know, it just wipes out the portion of the block that it needs to write to, erases it really quickly, and then writes to it, right? So obviously with the SSD, if it's having to do that whole empty block thing, it is a bit slower. It starts to slow down. So what SSDs do in software, what the operating system will try and do with a solid state drive, is write to all of the open blocks first. So if it has a block that's only been partially written to, and it has a free, complete open block available, it's going to opt to write directly to the open block because then it could just do a write. It doesn't have to do this whole cache, merge, read, or delete, write sort of action. But what happens then as your hard drive fills up or as you're using the drive over time, what happens when you run out of empty blocks on the SSD? That's going to happen. So at that point, it's forced to start using the slower read to cache, modify block and cache, erase block, write block method. And that's when performance on your SSD starts to slow down. And by slow down, I'm meaning it's not necessarily slow, but it's not as fast as it was the day you installed that SSD drive. It's not your fresh SSD drive. And so now we get to trim, okay? And what trim is it's something that allows the operating system to tell a solid state drive when blocks of data are no longer considered in use and can be erased. So then it can actively do what's called garbage collection, basically, and go through, erase that block so that the next time it comes around to a write, that block is completely empty on the SSD and free and available to write to. Now, Apple has disabled trim in OS X. So there has been a tool around for a while called Trim Enabler that would allow you to basically turn on this functionality in the operating system where it can go through, inform the, you know, the operating system can inform the solid state drive when blocks are available to be erased and garbage collected, and everything works beautifully. Now, the problem is that in OS X Yosemite, Trim Enabler no longer works, or doesn't work without actually doing a hack. What Apple did was they put in a new check, because the way Trim Enabler works is it actually has to put in a kernel extension, modify the kernel, and Apple in Yosemite now requires that there is a signature for any app that modifies the kernel extensions, and only Apple, I think, it's my understanding, only Apple has that certificate or that key. So in order for Trim Enabler to work in Yosemite, you have to specifically go into your operating system and turn off that security check. And then you can run it. But the problem is now you have a security risk, because there can be malicious apps that might try and do kernel things that you don't want running, and your Mac is now exposed. And just in general, I'm not a huge fan of kernel extension hacking. It's a low-level kind of tweaking of the operating system. There's lots of software that will go in and do it so that you can kind of enhance your operating system capabilities. But in general, I just find that they cause trouble further down the road, because you'll go to do an operating system update, and if the kernel extension hasn't been updated or is broken, you start to have all kinds of problems. And because it's at such a low level, it's hard for a lot of folks to troubleshoot. So consequently, I did install an SSD from OWC in my Mac, but I did not use Trim Enabler because I found out it was doing this kernel extension thing. But a lot of people use it. It works just fine in OS X Mavericks from what people tell me, and it handles this sort of garbage collection and keeps your SSD drive working and reading and writing at optimal performance. So a lot of people like to use it. But the reality is you may not need Trim, and I think this is where Apple took the philosophy of sort of disabling it, because their SSDs and SSDs from companies like Crucial and OWC, they have active garbage collection built into the firmware on their drive. And all of this that I'm talking to you about came about because Derek had emailed me. He was asking about this specifically to Crucial support, and they gave him a response to let him know, you know, yeah, we have active garbage collection on here, but here's some things that you need to know about it. And a lot of folks have argued that Trim support in the operating system is better than relying on the firmware support that might be built into an SSD drive. So I'm going to give you the information. You're going to kind of have to make your choice on whether you want to use Trim Enabler and, you know, get the functionality in the operating system, or whether you want to go with what's sort of built into your drive. I'm opting to go with what's built into the drive, but here's what you need to know about it. Active garbage collection in the firmware relies on the drive being idle for an extended period of time. When it's doing that, then the firmware on the drive will actually go through and restore those cells, create the free space, and basically get the drive working at optimal performance. The trouble is that active garbage collection, in order for that to happen, the SSD has to be sitting idle for this extended period of time, and that may or may not be happening on your drive. So in a lot of cases, even though you've got the firmware support on your drive, it might not be doing this garbage collection. So the folks from Crucial said the best way to ensure that this happens is every couple months or so, boot your Mac up to the startup manager screen. So that's when you hold down the option key when booting your Mac, boot it up to that screen, and then leave it on that screen for an extended period of time. They say preferably overnight. So this would be a procedure that you'd want to perform maybe before you go to bed, boot into that mode. And then I guess when it's in that mode, what'll happen is it provides power to the SSD but keeps the drive idle. And so this firmware active garbage collection function can happen. And then they recommend after that to prevent the SSD from degrading again, that you go into system preferences, into the energy saver preferences. And this seemed a little bit counterintuitive to me, but I'm going to trust them on this one. They say make sure the put the hard disk to sleep when possible option is unchecked. You would think putting it to sleep would put it into idle state, but I think what it does is it shuts it down. So you need to make sure that, you know, it's up and running, but just sitting in an idle state for this garbage collection to happen. So if you do those two things, you probably don't need to worry so much about Trim Enabler, and you won't have the kinds of problems, or you won't need to disable one of what I would consider to be a critical security feature in OS X Yosemite. But, you know, there you go. That's the information. That's sort of my understanding of how this stuff works. I'm certainly not an expert, and I'm still kind of digging in and learning this, but I just wanted to share my information, and you can kind of make your choice from there. Also, if you know a little bit more about this, if maybe you've dug in deeper than I have, certainly share your comments and your experiences with us. Shoot us an email or an audio comment, maccast@gmail.com. Let's talk about screenshots on the Mac. This is something that's been built into the operating system for a long time. Something folks may not know is that there are kind of multiple ways to actually take a screenshot on the Mac. Probably the most common way is that a lot of people know about is pressing Command, Shift, and 3. That will take a screenshot of your entire screen wherever you are, and drop the file, I think, by default on your just on your desktop. There's also the Command Shift 4 option, which gives you a more interactive way to take a screenshot. It'll give you a little set of crosshairs, and then you can select the region. And another little tip and trick when you're doing screenshots this way that you may or may not be aware of is if you tap the space bar, once you see that little crosshair, you can actually get a little camera icon, and when you hover over different elements, say a window or a menu or a dock, it will take a screenshot specifically of just that item when you click the mouse. So those are a couple cool ways to do that. Also, when you're in the Command Shift 4 mode, there's a couple other little tricks. If you hold down the Shift key while making your selection, it will constrain that selection to just one direction. So, you know, you can kind of set up your width, and then when you want to do the height, hold the Shift key down, and it'll stay at that width and then allow you to, you know, set up the height that you want to get to. You can also hold down the Option key while doing this, and it will select from the center of your mouse pointer rather than from the corner. And also, if you need to get out, if you decide, hey, I don't want to take the screenshot, if you just hit the Escape key, it will get you out of the screenshot mode. So I think that's probably the most common way that, and the most well-known way that people know to take screenshots. What people might not know about is there's also a dedicated app that comes with OS X built in for taking screenshots called Grab. You'll find it in Applications in the Utilities folder. And with it, you can do the same sorts of things. You can do a selection. You can do a window screen grab. You can capture just a screen. But more importantly, you can also do a timed screen capture. So if you need to kind of move some elements into place, or you want to specifically, I think, get the cursor on screen when you actually grab your screenshot, you can do the timed screenshot, and it'll give you kind of a 10-second countdown. Also, with the Grab application in the preferences, you can set different types of cursors. So if you don't want to just have the typical arrow pointer, if you'd prefer to have a hand or a finger or some other, you know, an insertion bar, you can turn that on and get that in your screenshot. Well, recently, the reason I started thinking about this is Andrew emailed me and said he'd been using Grab, but he had a question about file formats.
Hi, Adam. This is Andrew from Yorkshire in the UK. And for the life of me, I can't work out how to do this, and I'm sure something somewhere has changed in OS X Yosemite. I have returned back to using Grab for a few bits and pieces in the last month or so, and I'm sure I used to be able to change somewhere the default file format for Grab from TIFF to JPEG, but all the old ways of doing that seem to have disappeared or don't work anymore. So has something changed somewhere? Maybe it was in a previous version. I'm not quite sure. So basically, how do I change the default file format of Grab from TIFF to JPEG? Can you help? Thanks.
Hey, Andrew. Unfortunately, I'm not going to be able to help with that one, because I don't think, and I don't remember, I could be getting this wrong, but I looked online and I didn't see any way, now or in the past to change the file format in Grab. It's always been TIFF, and it seems to be the default. The one thing you could do is after you take your screenshot, you could open it up, of course, in preview and save it back out as a different file format. But what you could do in the past, and it still seems to work in OS X Mavericks, but does not work in OS X Yosemite, is you could change the file format with the screen capture, the default way that I described earlier, the Command-Shift-3 or Command-Shift-4. I think out of the box, I can't remember if it's TIFF or PNG, but there is a terminal command that you can issue, a defaults write com.apple.screen capture command, setting the type to a preferred format. And you can put in JPEG, PNG, PDF, or TIFF, and that will work again in Mavericks, but apparently that is no longer available in Yosemite. So that might have been what you're thinking about and noticing doesn't work in Yosemite anymore, but it doesn't change or affect what the format is in Grab, only in the default sort of built-in screen capture of the operating system. But because of your question, what I did discover is that there is a third option for taking screenshots in Mac OS X, and I either had forgotten about this or was unaware of it, and that is you can actually do it right from inside Preview. So if you open up Preview and go into the File menu, there is a Take Screenshot option, and from there you can choose to take a screenshot as a selection, a window, or an entire screen. The only thing weird about it when I was playing around with it was that it's kind of hard to get to the window that you may be wanting to capture. The easiest way that I found to do it was to use Command Tab, because once you've enabled Take Screenshot, you're going to be in that screenshot mode and you can't really click on anything. So you're going to have to use the keyboard to kind of get to the screen you want, or position your windows in a way that you can get access to the thing you want to take a screen capture of. But the benefit of using Preview is that once you take the screenshot, it'll come in as a new preview document, and then all you have to do is use the save option, and from there it will give you a choice of file format. You could pick PNG or JPEG or PDF or TIFF or whatever file format you want. So you don't have to go through that extra step of maybe taking the screenshot and Grab and then opening it up in Preview and then resaving out the file. Now, all of this said, and as much as I like the fact that we have all these options as built-in options in Mac OS X, I think there are a bunch of other and better third-party apps for actually doing screen captures. And some of them are paid and some of them are not. I thought I'd just mention a few of the ones that I'm aware of and I really like. Clarify is an app. You can get it at clarifyit.com. It's $29.99. There's also Napkin from agedanddistilled.com. It's $39.99. And these are powerful tools. They have a bunch of functionality, including doing like annotations and additional things, keeping track and sort of a library of your screenshots and captures and things like that. I think both these applications are very good if you're doing a lot of documentation, those sorts of things. So you might want to look into those. But then there's also a couple free ones that have similar functionality and allow you to do annotations and some additional things. Sketch, which was my favorite until it was bought by Evernote. It's still a pretty good app, but they've changed it in some ways that for me just didn't really work. So you can look into that. But my current favorite and the one that I would recommend you try out is called Monosnap. And it's basically everything that Sketch was, with some more enhancements and improvements, but works very similarly. So if you were a fan of the original Sketch, you'll probably really like Monosnap. And what I love about Monosnap is it just sits up there in my menu bar, and I can pull it down and I can do timed screenshots. I can do all these things, selections, and then bring it into the app. I can then do annotations and send it off to cloud services, including they have their own service where I can just simply get a link that I can paste into somebody, put it in a tweet or something like that to show somebody something. So I think it's a really great app. Why it's free, I have no idea, but it is awesome and you should check it out. I hope they have some way of making money, because I hope it doesn't go away or get changed like Sketch did. But not really sure exactly your screenshot needs, but hopefully one of these solutions will kind of work for you. And hopefully we've answered your question about the Grab file format. I think that's pretty clear. You just can't change it. Okay, and then I have one last cool little quick tip for you. This one actually came from the gang over at Cult of Mac. They found a really neat project over on GitHub. GitHub user slong1987 has created this set of five simple little apps, I guess you'd call them, that you can run in OS X Yosemite to do a restart, sleep, log out, shut down, or lock action on your Mac. So each app only does the one thing. So if you launched the restart app, it would restart your Mac. If you launched the sleep app, it would put your Mac to sleep. And you might be thinking, well, that's a little bit weird. Why would you need a whole separate app for that? Well, this is the cool part, because once you have the apps installed in your applications folder, you can quickly activate those apps by launching them from Spotlight in Yosemite. So it has that cool new, you know, front and center spotlight dialog. You just hit the shortcut command space, start typing sleep, and hit enter, and your Mac will go to sleep. So you can quickly put your Mac to sleep. You quickly restart it if you need to. I think particularly the sleep and the lock commands are going to be super, super handy. I'm not on OS X Yosemite yet, but as soon as I am, I'm definitely going to be heading over to the GitHub project and downloading these little apps and putting them into my system. So if you'd like to grab them, I will have a link to them in the show notes at maccast.com. I'm just calling them shortcuts. So if you're looking for the link, you can grab it there. But with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors: Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, and Disk Label. Also, be sure to check out Text Expander Touch 3 for your iOS devices, as well as PDF Pen for iOS and PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can get more information and details on all of their software by going to smilesoftware.com. Gazelle, it's the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. You can find out what your used iPhone, iPad, or other Apple products are worth by going to gazelle.com. And lynda.com. Lynda.com helps you keep up to date with your software, pick up brand new skills, or explore new hobbies with their easy-to-follow video tutorials. You can get a free trial by simply going to lynda.com/maccast. That's lynda.com/maccast. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the MacCast. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. They're at cachefly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media at backbeatmedia.com. Now, I do have one more item to tell you about, and I'm pretty excited about this. If you've been listening to the show for a while, you know I am a big fan of Sphero. That is the iPhone-controlled ball, and more specifically and more recently, the Sphero 2.0. And also, the folks at Orbotics who make the Sphero, they have a new product out called the Ollie. And I probably told you about the Ollie as well. I picked one up immediately when I found out this was available. This is more like a cylinder with two little wheels on either end. Again, you can control with your iOS device through an app, and it is amazingly fun. It's super rugged. It's got these big knobby tires. You can run it around in the dirt, and it is fast. I think you can get the thing going up to 14 miles an hour. Well, I love these toys. Products. I don't even know if they're just technically toys anymore, because they've come out with a whole program for actually doing programming or teaching programming using the Sphero and the Ollie. They have an app for that as well. Really cool stuff. Well, they reached out to me and they're letting me give away some Ollies to you, including the brand new Dark Side Ollie. So it's an all black version of the Ollie. I've got a regular Ollie, a Dark Side Ollie, and a Sphero 2.0 to give away to one each. You don't get all of them. You're going to get one to three different MacCast listeners. And luckily, initially, they had said this was going to be just open to U.S. residents, but I emailed them back. They're opening it up worldwide, so anyone can enter. All you have to do is head to gosphero.com/MacCast-giveaway to sign up. So go to GoSphero, that's GoSphero.com/MacCast-giveaway, and you can sign up there. Again, I'll have a link in the show notes at maccast.com if you don't want to have to remember that. And in December, I think early December, we're going to give away to some of you some really cool Sphero products. And just if you're looking for a great holiday gift, I'm telling you, these are really, really cool. Boys, girls, even older kids on your list, and by older kids, I mean adults, would love to have a Sphero for the holidays. So check it out. GoSphero.com is the website. And thank you to them for enabling us to be able to give away some of these cool products. But with that, I think we're ready to finish up here. If you have any feedback for me, a comment, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode, you can send your emails or your audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. You're also welcome to call in on the listener hotline. That's at 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. Or you can also leave voicemail on Skype, and my Skype address is the MacCast. If you need show notes with links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. If you'd like to follow me online between shows, you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast, or you can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast. And we also have a Google Plus community. Just search for MacCast on Google Plus, and you will find us there. But that is going to do it for now. I'm also in this episode temporarily. I don't know if it's temporarily or not. I'm going to try to bring back a feature we had on the MacCast back in the day. So old school MacCast listeners, you'll know, in the past, at the end of every episode, I tried to play some new music from an indie artist, somebody who would give us permission to play their tracks. Obviously, you know, a lot of stuff is copyrighted and licensed and owned by record labels and things like that. But there's a bunch of bands out there that do stuff on their own and are looking for promotion, looking to get their stuff heard. Now, the track I'm going to play you today, these guys have been around for a while. They've been with record labels, but they just produced their own album. And I've been a big fan for a long, long time. As a matter of fact, they are listeners to the show. So, hey, guys, how are you doing? But they gave me their latest album and said, hey, if you want to play a track off this, we would love for you to do that. And there's a bunch of great tracks on here. It was really hard to pick. But I picked the track We the Mighty from their new album 9, which is available on iTunes, and I'll have a link to that in the show notes at maccast.com, or you can just search for Young Dubliners in iTunes and pick up all their albums. I mean, it's all really great stuff. They're an Irish rock band, and I love their music. I hope you like it, too. And if this works out, and I can actually get some music that I have permission to play, I'd love to kind of start to bring this back on a few episodes whenever I get something cool and I think it's something that I want to share with you. So if you're in a band and you have some music that you want to potentially get heard, just shoot it to me in an email. Let me know I have permission to play it, and we'll try and start doing that a little bit more again here on the MacCast. But for today, here is We the Mighty by the Young Dubliners. Enjoy, and I will talk to you all again real soon.
So grab a bag and I'll meet you at the station. I call you songs of love and emigration. So will I, we'll step into the great unknown. You'll miss the crack, but there's no turning back. When you get there, you won't be alone. So let's go, let's go. Call them up, tell them we're all coming over. There'll be no shamrocks and there'll be no folded clovers. It's just a party and we're only getting started. We'll fix your lonely and we'll fix your broken hearted. Different generation. The traveling people, a familiar situation. We work so hard if we can get a job.